Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Is Einstein Still Right? Black Holes, Gravitational Waves, and the Quest to Verify Einstein's Greatest Creation by Clifford M. Will and Nicholas Yunus. Narrated by Tom Perkins. Publisher's note: the print and ebook versions of this book include visual content, such as figures. Preface. A little over a century ago, over four consecutive Wednesdays in November 1915, Albert Einstein described to the Prussian Academy of Sciences a theory of gravity that he had been working on for 8 years. Among the audience of German scientists, a few were excited and impressed, many were mystified, and some were openly hostile. Outside the world of German science, the lectures had almost no impact. This was the middle of World War I, and except for a few neutral countries such as Switzerland and the Netherlands, Germany was effectively cut off from the rest of the world. Einstein, seriously ill from the grueling days and nights of calculating and from the food rationing and other privations of wartime Berlin, returned to his office to continue toiling on his new theory in relative obscurity. Just 4 years later, after British astronomers declared that Einstein was right about the sun's gravity bending light, international headlines proclaimed Einstein to be the successor to Isaac Newton, the herald of a strange new universe governed by rubbery time, warped space, and mathematics so abstruse that only a handful of people could possibly comprehend it. Einstein became an overnight science superstar, a status that he thoroughly enjoyed and occasionally disliked. But his brainchild, called general relativity, soon languished, burdened by a shortage of relevance, a lack of experimental support, and a reputation for being just too complicated. General relativity soon became little more than an afterthought in the world of physics. But by 2015, the 100th anniversary of general relativity, Einstein's theory had assumed its rightful place in the pantheon of physics. Its predictions had been tested and retested countless times, sometimes with mind-boggling precision. College bookshelves displayed textbooks on general relativity alongside conventional tomes on quantum mechanics, solid-state physics, and astronomy, and physics departments routinely taught general relativity to graduate and undergraduate students. The theory's relevance was being touted in fields ranging from high-energy physics to astronomy to cosmology. And modern-day science superstars such as Stephen Hawking could be seen or heard expounding on warped space-time on YouTube or in television shows such as The Big Bang Theory. It was even said that general relativity helps you to navigate your car or to find your misplaced smartphone through the manner in which its rubbery time must be accounted for in global navigation systems such as GPS. The crowning event of that centennial year was the September 14, 2015 detection of gravitational waves emitted by a pair of colliding black holes a billion light-years away from Earth. Einstein first predicted these waves in 1916, doubted their reality for a while in the 1930s, and believed that it would never be feasible to detect them. That detection, announced at a press conference in February 2016, made similar worldwide headlines, proclaiming that Einstein was right. More importantly, it initiated a new way of doing astronomy by listening to the universe rather than by looking at it. It also opened up new ways of putting Einstein's theory to the test using black holes, neutron stars, and gravitational waves. This book is about Einstein's creation of over 100 years ago, the general theory of relativity, with a definite slant toward experiment and observation. General relativity is a very beautiful theory. Einstein was guided toward its final form by aesthetic criteria of beauty, simplicity, and elegance. In the end, while he appreciated the role of experimental tests, deep down he believed that the theory was so beautiful that it had to be correct. But as the great American physicist Richard Feynman once said, "It doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is, it doesn't matter how smart you are. If it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong." In this book, we will describe how general relativity has passed every experimental test to which it has been subjected, an almost unbelievable perfect score. Yet the 1687 gravitation theory of Newton had a similar perfect score until general relativity took over. There is no reason to assume that general relativity is the last word on gravity. The observation of some anomalous effect or of a disagreement with Einstein's theory could tell us that it's time for a new theory. The 1998 discovery that the expansion of the universe is speeding up rather than slowing down is an example of an anomaly that has many people scratching their heads. Some of them are working hard on devising alternatives to general relativity to account for this. Therefore, we must keep testing general relativity, especially in new and unfamiliar arenas such as near black holes, or using gravitational waves in order to discover where or how or even if it might be superseded. The authors are theoretical general relativists, but we have both spent a substantial fraction of our research careers investigating how to verify or disprove general relativity by experiment or observation. We don't actually do experiments or make observations. Our experimental colleagues get nervous when we get too close to their equipment. Yet we have spent enough time talking to them and collaborating with them that we think we have a good feeling for what they do and how observations and experiments can test Einstein's theory. In this book, you will learn about some of the absolutely brilliant people who design the experiments, build the apparatus and instruments, and analyze the data. Some of them work alone or in small groups. Some belong to enormous collaborations of thousands of scientists, engineers, and technicians. These are the people who are doing the real work of finding out if Einstein is still right. Acknowledgements. We are very grateful to the many friends and colleagues who read parts of this book and sent us criticisms, corrections, and suggestions. Bruce Allen, Imre Bartos, Peter Bender, Donald Bruns, Alejandro Cordenas Avendano, Katerina Katsuanu, Ignazio Ciuffolini, Karsten Donsman, Shepard Doleman, Philip Eaton, Jim Huff, Cole Miller, Jenny Meyer, Paulo Freire, Reinhard Genzel, Ramesh Narayan, Jorge Pullen, Jessica Raley, David Reitze, Bernard Schutz, and Norbert Wex. Ultimately, we are responsible for any remaining errors or omissions. Clifford Will is grateful to the University of Florida for its support and to the Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris for its hospitality during extended stays in 2018 and 2019 while this book was being written. He is also grateful to the U.S. National Science Foundation for support under various grants. Nicholas Yunus is grateful to Montana State University and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for their support, as well as to the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics for its hospitality during extended workshops in 2019 while this book was being written. He is also grateful to the U.S. National Science Foundation and the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration for support under various grants. In this book, we will present thought experiments or situations where an observer does something. Rather than referring to the observer as he or she or they, we will go back and forth, sometimes using he and sometimes using she. This is by no means meant to exclude the possibility of observers or scientists who might be in gender transition or gender non-binary. Indeed, as physicists, we are well aware that our profession still needs to work hard to become more diverse in terms of gender, gender identification, race, ethnicity, and disability status, and we are committed to doing our part. We hope that our usage of pronouns in this way will keep our examples readable and enjoyable while still fostering a spirit of inclusiveness. Chapter 1. A Very Good Summer. The summer of 2017 was a smashing success for Albert Einstein. On Thursday, 25 May, in the waning weeks of spring that year, the journal Physical Review Letters posted a paper on its website. It described a 19-year campaign to watch two stars revolving around the gargantuan black hole at the precise center of our own Milky Way. These two stars are special because their orbits are very close to the black hole, so they whirl around it at speeds as high as a few percent of the speed of light, or 20 to 30 million kilometers per hour. These orbits are ideal to test Einstein's theory and to search for any possible deviations from its predictions. No deviations were found by the team, headed by Andrea Ghez of the University of California in Los Angeles. Einstein passed yet another test, the first one to involve orbits around a black hole. On Tuesday, 18 July at 8 p.m., standing in front of a forest of computer monitors in the German town of Darmstadt, a scientist at the Mission Operations Center gave the kill signal. 5 seconds later, 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, the LISA Pathfinder satellite shut down. A sigh of relief mixed with sadness was heard through the room. For 16 months, two identical cubes of gold and platinum alloy, 1.8 inches on a side, floated freely inside evacuated chambers in the satellite, maintaining almost exactly the same separation. The satellite had to periodically adjust slightly to account for shifts in its position caused by the bombardment of protons and radiation from the sun. If either cube made contact with the walls of its chamber, it would be a disaster. Specially made spacecraft thrusters and delicate sensors were essential if this mission was to succeed. For 16 months, the inside of this satellite was the quietest place in the universe. The success of the mission moved scientists one step closer to fulfilling a dream, the observation of gravitational waves with a space detector known as LISA. The month of August that summer was even better. On Monday, 14 August, the LIGO gravitational wave detectors in the USA and the Virgo detector in Italy picked up the signal from two black holes that merged 1.4 billion years ago. This wasn't the first gravitational wave signal detected. That momentous discovery had happened almost 2 years earlier, but it was the first to be detected simultaneously by the LIGO instruments in Washington State, near the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and in Louisiana, near Baton Rouge, and by the newly operational Virgo detector near Pisa, Italy. The triple detection enabled the scientists to do a much better job of pinpointing the location of the source on the sky. 3 days later, another burst of gravitational waves jiggled the sensitive mirrors of the LIGO and Virgo detectors. A few seconds after that, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, orbiting 534 kilometers above the Earth, sensed a burst of gamma rays coming from the same part of the sky. Some rapid detective work located the galaxy where both signals originated, and during the subsequent hours and days, astronomers around the world observed light in all its forms, from X-rays to radio waves, arriving at Earth from that same location. This time the source was two neutron stars about 140 million light-years from Earth, producing waves of gravity as the stars spiraled toward each other and merged. This was followed by a nuclear fireball of unimaginable power. This single observation revealed wonders about the universe that not even Einstein would have imagined. If you are wearing a gold necklace or a platinum ring, then there is a good chance that those precious and expensive elements were produced in a nuclear cataclysm, just like the one observed on that day. In fact, most of the gold and platinum in the universe is now thought to have been produced in the explosions that result when neutron stars collide. If that wasn't enough, the mere fact that the gravitational waves emitted right before the neutron stars merged and the first gamma rays emitted right after the merger arrived within 2 seconds of each other after traveling 140 million light-years revealed that the speed of gravitational waves and the speed of light are the same to 15 decimal places. Amazingly, this is precisely what Einstein had predicted in 1916. The following week, on Monday, 21 August, a lone amateur astronomer named Don Bruns settled into a folding patio chair near the top of Casper Mountain in Wyoming. With the press of a key, his laptop began instructing a Teleview Optics NP-101IS telescope to take a series of photographs of the sun during the total solar eclipse that crossed the United States that day. His goal was to replicate a famous 1919 experiment carried out by a British team of professional astronomers headed by Arthur Stanley Eddington. Eddington's measurements showed that gravity bends light exactly as Einstein had predicted, thereby overturning Newton's theory and making Einstein an international celebrity. Bruns wanted to see what could be done by a non-professional astronomer armed only with a modern commercial telescope, a CCD, charge-coupled device, camera, and computer-controlled instruments. After analyzing his data, Bruns also verified that light is bent by the sun just as Einstein predicted, and the accuracy of his measurements beat Eddington's by a factor of 3. Many of these events were covered by the press using headlines like, "Einstein was right, again." They reinforced an almost fairy tale version of the story of general relativity that goes something like this. In 1905, Einstein, working as a lowly clerk at the patent office in Bern, Switzerland, created the special theory of relativity. He then turned his attention to gravity, and after 10 years of hard work, created the general theory of relativity. In 1919, Eddington verified the theory by measuring the bending of starlight. Einstein became famous, his theory was triumphant, and everybody lived happily ever after. The actual story of general relativity is more complicated. Back in the 1920s, there was considerable skepticism about Eddington's results, particularly among American astronomers. Attempts in 1917 to measure the shift in the wavelength of sunlight toward the red end of the spectrum, an effect that Einstein considered another crucial test of his theory, failed to detect the effect. This apparently hurt Einstein's chances for the Nobel Prize until 1921, when it was finally awarded for his work on the photoelectric effect, not for general relativity. The theory was considered to be extremely complicated, with exotic new concepts like curved space-time that baffled most physicists and astronomers at the time, to say nothing of the general public. The headline of an article on relativity in the 9 November 1919 issue of the New York Times stated, "A book for 12 wise men, no more in all the world could comprehend it," said Einstein when his daring publishers accepted it. Einstein himself may have used some such phrase as early as 1916 in reference to a popular book on relativity that he had written. Another story has this idea originating with Eddington. Soon after the publication of the final form of general relativity in 1916, Eddington was one of the first to appreciate its importance and set out to master the theory and then to organize a team to measure the bending of light. At the close of the November 1919 joint meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society and the Royal Society of London, at which Eddington reported the successful measurements, a colleague purportedly said, "Professor Eddington, you must be one of 3 people in the world who understand general relativity." To which Eddington demurred. The colleague persisted, saying, "Don't be modest, Eddington." Eddington replied, "On the contrary, I am trying to think who the 3rd person could be." Perhaps only a handful of people understood it, but millions were fascinated by it and wanted to read about it and about Einstein. In the popular press, the scientific revolution engendered by general relativity was placed on a par with the insights of Copernicus, Kepler, and Newton. Editorial after editorial marveled at what was called one of the greatest achievements in the history of human thought, but at the same time complained about the difficulty of understanding it. Einstein himself wrote a long article for the Times of London in late 1919, attempting to explain the theory to a general audience. His picture graced the cover of the 14 December 1919 issue of the German news magazine Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung, with the caption, "A new great figure in world history." But there was a sense among scientists that the only thing this complex theorizing was good for was to predict minute deviations from Newton's grand theory. Experimentalists held sway in the physics of that time, and they felt that general relativity would never play a role in mainstream science. As a result of this skepticism, the science of general relativity gradually became stagnant and sterile. By the mid-1920s, Einstein had turned most of his attention to what would become a futile quest for a unified field theory that would combine gravitation and electromagnetism, and many other relativity researchers followed suit. With only a few exceptions, most work in general relativity during the next 35 years was devoted to abstract mathematical questions and issues of principle, and was carried out by a small band of practitioners. Science historian Jean Eisenstadt has called this period the low water mark for Einstein's theory. A classic illustration of the attitude toward Einstein's theory at the end of this period is the advice given in 1962 to a newly minted graduate of the California Institute of Technology, about to head for Princeton to do graduate work. A famous Caltech astronomer advised him that he should absolutely not work on general relativity when he got to Princeton, because it would never have anything useful to contribute to physics or astronomy. Luckily for many of us, the student, Kip Thorne, ignored the advice. As Kip headed east for the ivy-covered walls of Princeton, Caltech astronomers were on the verge of announcing the discovery of strange objects that they called quasi-stellar radio sources, or quasars. These were very distant, very energetic sources of radio waves that defied explanation in terms of conventional physics. A few people started to wonder if general relativity might help to provide an explanation, and convened a special conference on quasars, bringing together astrophysicists and general relativists. Held in Dallas in December 1963, this historic conference would come to be known as the First Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics. Within a few years, other discoveries pointed to a definite role for general relativity in astrophysics. In 1965 came the detection of the cosmic background radiation left over from the Big Bang. In 1967, radio astronomers discovered the first of many pulsars, now understood to be rapidly spinning neutron stars. And 1971 saw the discovery of a compact, powerful X-ray source orbiting a normal star, the first black hole candidate. You needed general relativity if you wanted to begin to understand these phenomena. These discoveries helped bring about a renaissance for general relativity, in which it would begin to rejoin the mainstream of physics and astronomy. This was aided by advances in technology such as atomic clocks, lasers, and superconductors, and by the development of the space program, which would provide the tools to perform new, high-precision tests of Einstein's theory, putting it on a solid experimental foundation. After all, if you needed to use a relativistic theory of gravity to understand quasars, pulsars, and the cosmic background radiation, it would be very good to know if Einstein's theory was the correct one to use. For despite Einstein's fame, by this time there were alternative theories of gravity competing with general relativity for primacy. One of these, known as the Brans-Dick theory, named after Princeton University's Robert Dick and his student Carl Brans, made a credible claim that it was just as viable as Einstein's theory. This competition sparked a major effort to carry out new and better experimental tests to determine if Einstein was right or not. Other factors helped set the stage for this rebirth of general relativity research. Ironically, one of these may have been the death of Einstein himself in April 1955. No other topic in physics was so closely tied to a single, towering individual. It was not uncommon in those days for the few practitioners of general relativity to make a pilgrimage to Princeton to describe their work to the Great One, and hopefully to receive his approval. On the occasion of the centenary of general relativity in 2015, the French mathematical physicist Yvonne Choquet-Bruhat wrote a charming reminiscence of her visit to the Institute for Advanced Study in 1951 as a 27-year-old postdoctoral researcher. She visited Einstein several times during that year, explaining her mathematical work on the existence of solutions of Einstein's equations and listening to Einstein describe his work on unified field theory. He pronounced himself very pleased with her work, which actually turned out to be one of the major milestones of the field. His work on the unified theory ultimately went nowhere. But after Einstein passed from the scene, the field was somehow free to make its own way forward. Another factor may have been an emerging sense of community among the small group of specialists in relativity beginning with a conference in July 1955 in Bern, Switzerland, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of special relativity. Regular international meetings on the subject were organized. By 1959, at the third such meeting, held in Royaumont, France, leaders of the field formed the International Committee on General Relativity to aid the organization of future meetings, to disseminate lists of published papers in the field, and to provide information on research groups around the world. This would ultimately evolve into the International Society on General Relativity and Gravitation, with elected officers, annual dues, and its own scientific journal. The fact is that science is more than a body of knowledge. It is also a community of researchers who advance the field by sharing knowledge, collaborating and competing with one another, and even correcting each other so that scientific facts can be established and progress can be made. Some historians of science believe that the emergence of this community of relativists in the late 1950s made it possible for them to respond nimbly and effectively to the new astronomical discoveries of the 1960s. By the time of the 1979 centenary of the birth of Einstein, the relativistic renaissance that had begun in the 1960s was in full swing. The outpouring of books commemorating that birthday attested to the vigor and excitement of research in the field. A toolbox of techniques for solving Einstein's complicated equations in a wide range of situations had been developed, and researchers were turning to computers to help solve the more complex problems. Many experimental tests of general relativity had been performed. Some exploited new technologies to do improved versions of classic experiments, such as measurements of the bending of light using radio waves from quasars rather than using visible light from stars. Others were new tests never envisioned by Einstein, such as the Shapiro time delay, an excess delay in the propagation of radar signals as they passed near the sun on their way to track the orbits of planets or spacecraft. Black holes were an accepted and understood part of the theory, and observational evidence that they actually exist was mounting. A model for the basic structure and evolution of the universe was in good shape, and cosmologists were beginning to explore what might have happened in the first trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. The nature of quasars, ironically, remained a mystery after 20 years of study, while a pretty good theory of pulsars was in hand. The centenary year itself was inaugurated by a stunning announcement. At the 9th Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics, held in Munich in December 1978, Joseph H. Taylor of the University of Massachusetts described the latest result from a remarkable new testing ground for general relativity that he and his student Russell Hulse had discovered in 1974. This new arena for experimental relativity was a pulsar in orbit about a companion star, colloquially called the binary pulsar. Taylor reported how observations of the orbit of the pulsar since 1974 had led to the first confirmation of one of the most important predictions of Einstein's theory, the existence of gravitational waves. 19 years later, Taylor and Hulse would win the Nobel Prize in Physics, the first ever bestowed for work related to general relativity. If general relativity seemed to be triumphant in 1919, it was surely triumphant now. But there were some clouds on the horizon, and there would be more to come. None of them posed a direct threat to the supremacy of Einstein's theory. As of 1979, it had not failed a single experimental test, and that perfect record continues to today. But they suggested the possibility that Einstein might not have had the final word on gravity. The first cloud was theoretical. In addition to developing special and general relativity, Einstein was one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics. And although Einstein ultimately found himself at odds with some of the interpretations of quantum physics, he would have been the first to admit that it was spectacularly successful in its ability to account for measurable effects in the subatomic world. And even some of the spooky probabilistic effects that he frequently railed against, "God does not play dice," have been shown by recent experiments to be true and unavoidable. quantum mechanics rules everything from the practical, chemistry, semiconductors,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?